Hello and welcome to Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Jamp and Luke Cutford.
Hello.
Hi. Howdy.
This week, we're talking about imitation illnesses and dummy diseases. But first, a thanks to our patrons.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That took you a little while, didn't it?
Yeah, sorry. I'm lagging.
Don't worry, we've got a question to move quickly on from that pitiful, pitiful thank you. The question is, when do you last remember vomiting? Head over to our channel on YouTube and leave a comment there letting us know when you last vomited. I want to know. I very much want to know.
When's the last time you remember vomiting?
Well, I don't know if I can say the last time I vomited, because... trigger warning, I made myself vomit.
No, Luke.
Yeah, but that's what,
oh, no.
Only because I felt really ill. Not,
oh.
Yeah, not for like a reason for me wanting to vomit for any other reason than I felt ill.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Jamp?
I probably vomited while I was sick, but the last time I actually probably remember vomiting was when I went out drinking at 4 p.m. with a friend, and I hadn't eaten anything all day, and by 8 p.m. I was... projectile vomiting into the streets of Soho.
Oh, mine was like 3 weeks ago, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, really? Well, yeah. Mine is similar to Jam's in that the last time I vomited was because I drank too much. Usually I don't get hungover. This day my body decided that I would get hungover and it didn't know how to deal with it.
You're getting old.
Yeah.
You were there. Remember that?
We saw you.
Yeah.
Was I?
Yeah.
In your state.
Do you not remember? Disgustingly it was kind of hungover.
When was this?
We were meant to be recording Sci Guys and it ended up not happening for a while.
Well, look, put it this way. I could do what I want before Sci Guys and I'm usually fine. It was just this one time out of many that that my body said, hey, no.
Yeah.
And it was like all of the time. It was all of the hangovers that I haven't had throughout my life seemed to come together into this one specific one.
We've been waiting.
Scott Pilgrimed you.
Yeah. But that is not exactly what we're talking about today. As I said, up top, we are talking about imitation illnesses and dummy diseases. Now, our patrons have voted for this topic. They have voted for it. Can you guess what it is from this?
Imitation illnesses and dummy diseases. Is it like illnesses that look like other illnesses?
Oh, not quite. This is Munchausen by proxy
syndrome.
Not Munchausen syndrome, which we may cover in the future, but Munchausen by proxy. So, do you know what it is? Why don't you tell me what you think it is?
I know the vague story of Gypsy Rose.
Oh.
How would you describe it? It's where somebody in a position of care for someone else, usually someone who's disabled or a child, either pretends that the child is ill or makes them ill for, I don't know, for sympathy? Like, what? I don't know.
Or like in order to be in the caring role?
In order to assume the caring role.
You're pretty much spot on. Let's kind of move away from the why.
Yeah.
Because that is a tough one.
Yeah.
We'll get to it later because this is a really complicated thing. And I'm not going to lie. I may get some of this just a little bit off because there's conflicting stuff from different places. And really, when you start looking into all of this, it's kind of all over the place. So forgive me for any inaccuracies. I've tried to be as accurate as possible, take from as many sources as possible. But the NHS will say something different to some studies that I've read from, 2017, 18, 2020. And a lot of these studies are also about Munchausen itself. So Munchausen by proxy, here's a quote from the NHS. Fabricated or induced illness, FII, is a rare form of child abuse. It happens when a parent or carer exaggerates or deliberately causes symptoms of illness in the child. Now, this is an okay definition, I think. I don't think it's a perfect one because, as you said, it's not just parents and children. It can also be seen in someone that is caring for, say, an elderly person or someone that's caring for someone that's disabled. Now, it's also no longer called Munchausen by proxy. You probably spotted that there when I said fabricated or induced illness. There are a number of names. Fabricated or induced illness is obviously used by the NHS. It's classified under factitious disorders in the DSM-5. Now, you definitely know about factitious disorders because I have mentioned them recently. What other episode have we done in the past few weeks that had a guest that also spoke about an appearance of symptoms of something, not an illness, but appearance of symptoms without the actual cause of said symptoms?
Is it hysterical pregnancies?
Yes, Luke, well done.
Hysterical pregnancies.
Yes, Luke, yay. Well done. Yes, exactly. Hysterical pregnancies. So you can see, we were talking about hysterical pregnancies, and that kind of brought up the concept of factitious disorders, because those are Those are kind of, you can broadly describe them as kind of when it's difficult when there's no cause for symptoms, and not just no apparent cause for symptoms, but symptoms are presenting nonetheless. However, I'm fairly sure that with factitious disorders, there is sort of at least the idea that the symptoms are almost being made up in some way, rather than being due to some unknown cause, right? Because those are obviously two different things. It's different to say this person is ill and seems to be genuinely ill, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
Let's say fibromyalgia, right? Where this person has pain, but I can't tell. But we don't necessarily know why, where the pain is coming from, or something, right?
Right.
So you mean the symptoms in the child?
So the symptoms in the child, yeah.
Because there's also the symptoms of being the person who's doing the thing, being the adult in that situation, and we don't necessarily, like you said, we don't know the why. We don't necessarily know what the cause of that is.
Yeah, that's tough as well, because I wouldn't even necessarily call those symptoms. And they're described on the NHS as signs. And signs and symptoms are different things, as people in our comments have told us before. Signs and symptoms are different. The actual difference is not super important right now. But the symptoms of the child are obviously false, right? False or induced by the parent. Exactly. When we start talking about the sort of signs of these sort of factitious disorders in the carer role, that is more complex, because when you call that a symptom, that would almost imply sort of illness in some sense, and that's putting a lot. You know, I mean, that's putting a lot on there. It's very difficult to determine whether there is sort of illness or not. It's very complicated,
and potentially absolving them of responsibility for their actions
to some extent. Yeah, absolutely. So as I was saying, factitious disorders are in the DSM-5. We've spoken about them recently in our hysterical pregnancies episode with Noah Finns, which you should definitely go ahead and check out. Not necessary for this episode, but it's a good time nonetheless. So factitious disorder imposed on another is the name for Munchausen's by proxy. Now, this is, you can see what's going on here. Obviously, you've got factitious disorders, and now in the DSM-5, those are split, I think, into two different sort of groups. You've got factitious disorder imposed on, I think, the self, or, you know, factitious disorder imposed on oneself, and then factitious disorder imposed on another, FDIA. Now, it's essentially people with FDIA, or in the case of FDIA, rather, they will sort of pretend that the person that is in their care is sick, or they'll make them sick. And there is no apparent gain for this. And this is why it would be considered
like
a disorder
or something.
Or a syndrome. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Right. Because now if I was, you know, in a position of care over JAMP, and I was to be given lots and lots of money for JAMP being not very well, it would be in my best interest to make JAMP not very well. And I have to say, I would absolutely do it. And society would look at me and say, Corey, this makes sense. We understand why you're... We don't agree. It's naughty and wrong, but we understand why you're doing it.
Yeah. Respect the hustle.
Whereas with factitious disorder imposed on another... Whereas with factitious disorder imposed on another, I feel like the reason that this is sort of considered a more of a sort of disorder is because we can't, as a sort of your average rational person, cannot see any of gain for this, you know? So they'll pretend that the person in their care is sick, and they'll look for treatment, and they could go to different sort of care facilities for this sort of thing. And it's been around, I think, in the literature. So Munchausen syndrome has been around in the literature since 1951. So it's you know, quite an old, I mean, relatively old in terms of, like, you know, we've known about it for a while. And here's a quote from a study that I was reading from 2017. The main characteristics of factitious disorder imposed on self are feigning of physical and or psychological signs and symptoms, and induction of injury or disease associated with identified fraud. So that's when it's imposed on self.
Yeah.
I don't really want to talk too much about that today, but it's very difficult to extricate the two, because they have almost exactly the same name. Do you know what I mean? And whenever you see a paper about one, it's almost always a paper about the other as well. So don't get these confused. So you've got Munchausen's or factitious disorder imposed on self, and then you've got Munchausen's by proxy, which is now called factitious disorder imposed on another. Yeah? Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Great. So as I said, it was first described in 1951. That's Munchausen syndrome was first described in 1951 by Dr. Richard Allen John Asher, because he's had patients who were sort of sort of seem to intentionally be making sort of creating symptoms in themselves. And he was like, okay, well, let's just call it this. That's what this is. It's Munchausen's. And then in 1977, so a good 26 years later, Sir Samuel Roy Meadow, fantastic names today, and this is, I'll just quote this from a paper that I read, used the term Munchausen syndrome by proxy to describe children whose mothers produce histories of illness to their children and who support such histories by fabricated physical signs and symptoms or even altered laboratory tests.
Ooh.
So is that crucial that they fabricate the symptoms, as in they actually make them happen, or just that they pretend they happened?
I think both are the same thing.
Yeah, it could be either, right. I think.
Both are, I mean, as in pretending that they happened and pretend and making them happen.
Well, I just mean one is, that's another level of abuse, to actually make your child ill.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than just pretending your child is ill. That's like a different level.
Yeah, and you've hit on this you've hit the nail on the head there, that this is really difficult to talk about as a sort of mental disorder, despite the fact that it's in the DSM-5, because it's almost inherently, I mean, I say almost inherently, it is inherently abusive, right? Now, you can see how people with mental health disorders can be abused or abuse others, and people often talk about narcissists, for example, as being inherently abusive, which to some extent is not very fair to those people, right? Because they're living their lives as themselves, and this is how their brain sort of works. This is how they engage with the world. And it seems almost callous to cast anyone with narcissistic personality disorder as an irredeemable, awful person, right?
Yeah.
Whereas, and I'm not saying that, you know, that people with a factitious disorder imposed on another or present with that way are irredeemable or awful people or whatever, but inherent in that sort of diagnosis is an abusive relationship, right?
With a child,
I find... With someone that's in your care.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I find interesting, right?
Yeah.
Like, it is interesting that inherent in this sort of disorder is abuse, and you don't often see that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's why when we're talking about this, we're not just talking about a disorder, we're also talking about cases of fairly extreme abuse, right?
Yeah, because it's interesting when you said the NHS definition, it went very quickly to is a form of child abuse.
Yeah.
And I found that interesting because that's almost, I mean, that's important because especially in the case of children, it's so important that the person doing the abuse is a strong second in the compared to the child being abused. Yeah. But what's interesting is that it's almost like it's almost like the abuse is if you view it like a mental disorder, the abuse is a manifestation of the mental disorder. Whereas this is sort of going, the abuse is primary. And then the cause of the abuse, that's sort of secondary. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, what I was going to say is that you've hit the nail, you've done it again, that you're spot on. That is why we don't necessarily call it Munchausen's by proxy anymore. That's why there's been this sort of shift, but then again, there's still some holdovers from when it was called that. It's difficult. It's not quite a sort of, it's not quite a situation of multiple personality disorder versus DID, dissociative identity disorder, where there has been a very sort of clear shift between multiple personalities to DID,
mm-hmm.
right? Or even, say, gender identity disorder to gender dysphoria. There's quite clear-cut shifts there. You're not necessarily going to be seeing lots of papers talking about gender identity disorder in, you know, 2020, 2017, 2018, because it was updated in DSM-5 in, oh gosh, come on off the top of your head, Corey, maybe 2013-ish?
Yeah.
When was the DSM-5? Doesn't really matter. But, you know, I mean, that's when it was updated, and once that was updated, the sort of language changed. But Munchausen's is still in papers now, despite the fact that they'll go on to say, it's called factitious disorder. And it's almost right. like clickbait, you know, because that's what people know it by.
Well, that's what this episode would be called.
It's going to be called Munchausen's by proxy.
Yeah, because I've never heard of the other name.
Well, no one's going to know what it is.
But
that was what was voted in by the patrons, and I try to keep it the same as what they've asked for.
That's really interesting, though. Like what you say, though, is that calling it Munchausen's by proxy, because that is the colloquial name, and that's what people knows it by. That's important, especially when you're making a podcast and people want to find the podcast if they want to learn about that thing. But it's almost like an entire separate category, because Munchausen's, when you're just making yourself ill or pretending to be ill or whatever, is a different thing to when you're abusing a child.
So yeah, and this is what this is a part of the reason for the shift in language, I think, is to focus more on the victim sort of this abuse. So instead of so Munchausen syndrome is it's not really necessarily called that anymore either. It's still called factitious disorder imposed on self.
Mm.
And then you've got factitious disorder imposed on another, and you can see how that's focusing a little bit more on the other rather than
by proxy.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And that was the reason potentially for that shift. But speaking of sort of the old term, right, which we may use sort of throughout this just for understandability, right, for the people listening, we'll try not to, but it's obviously the one that we know, it's the one that they'll know. So the term Munchausen syndrome actually, as I said, came back in 1951, but can you guess why it's Munchausen? Because if you remember, Dr. Yeah. Richard Allen John Asher came up with this.
It wasn't a name.
Is Munchausen German? Is it?
Yeah, sounds German. I believe it sounds German to me.
Is Munchausen the first person who was doing it, or was discovered to do it, or studied doing it?
No, not at all. This is great. This is actually really interesting. So, Munchausen, it comes from Baron Munchausen, also known as Karl Friedrich, Hieronymus Brecht. Freer von Munchausen. Or it'd be Munchausen, wouldn't it? Anyway, like my German pronunciation isn't great, but it comes from someone who lived from 1720 to 1797, who told he was a storyteller, and he told basically tall tales, very unbelievable stories about his life. He was known to be an embellisher of the truth.
Yeah, so yeah, like the boy who cried wolf.
Yeah, exactly. So it's almost like if you think about it, it's named after a historical figure.
Didn't even pretend to be ill.
No, who in some degree was known for, like, you know,
embellishing and lying.
So, okay, put it this way. It's like narcissistic personality disorder. Oh, go Corey. Awesome. Bringing it back around completely accidentally. What is narcissistic personality disorder named after?
Narcissus.
And who is Narcissus?
A Greek god.
No.
Narcissus,
and I may be slightly off on this because I've not studied ancient Greek in some time. Narcissus was a person who was so captivated by his own reflection in the water that he could not bear to move away and look away from it. And he turned into, do you remember? A daffodil.
A mirror.
A daffodil.
A daffodil.
I've ever heard this story.
No, but if you look at the scientific name for a daffodil, what is it? Narcissus.
Is it?
Great.
Yes.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Learned something new.
So that's where this all comes from.
You're very excited about this.
Do you not know what I love this stuff?
I remember never the Narcissus story now you said it, but
I've never even heard the Narcissus story.
I love
really?
Really?
Never.
Fell in love with their own reflection in the mirror.
Never.
You know, in the river. They look in the river and they fall in love with their own reflection. No. And then I think they like starve. They like starve staring at their own reflection because they don't do anything all day.
Yeah, just die. But yeah, basically just sit there and look.
It's like a myth. Yeah. That's so funny.
Yeah. So it was. So he was a demigod. He was the son of the river god, Cephisus, and a nymph, Lirope. And he was just very good looking. Caught his reflection in a sort of pond or a sort of, you know, lake or whatever.
Mm.
Did not move. Turned into a daffodil.
How fun! Is that the first time he'd ever seen himself?
they probably didn't have many mirrors kicking about back then, did they?
Oh yeah, it's a big revolution when they invented mirrors.
Wow!
Only it's the French who invented mirrors, and then they wouldn't tell anyone how to make them. And then the mirrors were really expensive. Someone invented the mirrors, and then they were really expensive. And then people who made mirrors were like super famous and rich and high up in the hierarchy. And then another country figured out how to make mirrors, and the entire mirror industry collapsed.
No. I think mirrors have been dated back as about 4,000 BCE, but I know of stories, and this is from Pokemon, I know about mirrors existing a long, long time ago, because you would just polish, I think, bronze until it became very, very shiny. And obviously it's not as good as the mirrors that we've got today, which have like very little sort of color, like, you know, they don't discolor your sort of reflection very much. But you could polish, you polish a metal like bronze. And the reason I know that is because there's a Pokemon that is entirely based off of a bronze mirror.
Great.
Bronzor. There you go.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, right? Ding-a-ling-ling, it's the ad bell. What are we advertising today?
We're advertising our spicy merch. I am wearing the tardigrade beanie that we're selling. It's a little tardigrade boy, little water bear going, ooh.
And if you like the tardigrade beanie, you could also get our matching tardigrade t-shirt with a little smiling tardigrade that isn't going, ooh, but is going,
And if you like the tardigrade t-shirt, you might also like the Sci Guys little pin badges we've made. Wow. They don't match, but they do say Sci Guys, and you can show your love for Sci Guys in your pin badge collection, and they're very cute.
Yeah, it's the actual logo.
And there's still a chance to grab our Sci Guys calendar, which will give you a discount on the future calendar if you get it now.
And an extra episode of Sci Guys, all about calendars.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, they will get
calendar
that.
Calendar episode, yeah.
Well, that's the spawn from ourselves. Back to the episode.
So, bringing it back to Munchausen's, I really do enjoy in science where we take names from mythology and the past and history and all of that. I think it's very interesting. It, you know, adds a fun little quality of history to science. So, Munchausen named after someone that just said a lot of bloke. Yeah, it's just some guy that told a lot of tall tales. So let's kind of get into some of the stats here. So. I don't know if I've said it explicitly, but you could probably gather that factitious disorder imposed on another and factitious disorder itself, or factitious disorder imposed on self, FDIA and FDIO, FDIS. So hard to say. See, Munchausen's is so much easier, but we'll make an effort. These disorders are rare. They're not common, you know? Okay, so I say they're rare and not common. This is going to sound more common to you. But you need to think about the numbers here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Apparently, around about 1% of hospital admissions could roughly be attributed to Munchausen's.
Just like gingers, sure.
Yes. Yeah. Now that sounds like a lot.
Yeah, that does sound like a lot.
But not everyone the people that have factitious disorder, and this is factitious disorder imposed on self. So people that have FDIS are more likely to go to the hospital.
Yes.
More often. Right. So they will be overrepresented in the number. Because I have been to the hospital a couple times in the past year. Yeah. Right? That's an uncommonly high amount of times. Right, exactly.
I've not been since 2016.
Exactly. Whereas someone that is consistently thinking themselves to be or making themselves to be ill in some way is going to be visiting more hospitals more often.
But right? I'd imagine that factitious disorder imposed on other has low admission rate because they don't want to find out that the child doesn't have the illness.
Yeah, no, you think that, but I don't have the admission rates to hospitals, right. But what I do have the sort of, so it accounts for 0.04% of child abuse cases, just to sort of clarify for FDIS in hospitalized patients. It's 1.3%, not 1%. I apologize. But yeah, 0.04% of child abuse cases. So not very common, but then it's you can understand why maybe like why that might be, right? You're more likely just to be a person, right? Than to be a person with a child.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? And I'm not saying you're more likely to be a person without a child. You're more likely to be a person.
Because a load of the child abuse cases are not people with children or people in care. They're just dreadful people who abuse children.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Hold on. Sorry.
So when you're talking about child abuse stats, you're more likely to be a person that's not a carer of a child than you are to be a person who is a carer of a child.
So what I'm saying is that with factitious disorder imposed on self, in order to sort of present with factitious disorder imposed on another, there needs to be another that's in your care. Mm-hmm. You're more likely to be just a person, either with someone or without someone in your care. Than you are to be someone with someone in your care. Yeah. Because because having someone in your care is included in the group of just being a person. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But you're comparing different statistics. One was comparing statistics of hospital admissions and the other is comparing statistics of child abuse cases.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that... So I'm not trying to compare these two stats. What I'm saying is that you can understand why you'd probably see less hospital admissions for people. So you had said you would be less likely to see hospital admissions for a factitious disorder imposed on another because they don't want to be found out.
Yeah.
I'm saying that's not necessarily the best way to look at it because part of it is that they that they think the child is ill, and so they're taking them to the doctor and making them ill and all of these different things, right?
They actually think the child is ill, as opposed to their pretend.
This is where it's really tough for me to figure out, right? We'll parse through it as we're going through the episode, right? But whether they think the child is ill or not, or whether they know the child isn't ill on all levels, and they are intentionally making them ill, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's hard to know how someone rationalizes something to themselves. So I guess on some level you could say that they know the child isn't ill, but regardless, they'll still take them to doctors and whatnot and make them ill. And yeah, sure, they might be slightly less likely to want to take the child or take the person in their care to see a physician. But part of, I think actually part of this concept is that they are taking them into sort of into hospitals and in to see doctors and whatnot. And what I'm saying here is that the reason that you might see a discrepancy there is that you're more likely to be a person, right? So you're more likely to just be a person that is either caring for someone or is not caring for someone than you are to be a person who is caring for someone, right? Because being a person that is caring for someone is a subset of just people.
So what you're saying is that hypothetically, if we were to have a statistic on the number of people who are admitted to hospital due to by proxy or inflicted on other, that it might be true that it's lower because of what I said, which is that they might not admit them. That might be true. We don't know. Don't take that as true. But it also might be lower because there are less people with children than there are just people. So you're more likely to be a person than you are to be a carer. And so the statistics will naturally be higher because they will make up a larger proportion of hospital admissions because there are more people than there are people with children. But that's an incredibly low percentage of child abuse cases are Munchausen's by proxy, which is super interesting. It's actually very, very, very rare. 0.004% of child abuse cases.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, there could be any number of reasons for that. But like the thing is that you've got to, if you look at it this way, you've got to both be in a caring role for someone else and also be in some way predisposed to this disorder. And then also get, like, you know, not be caught before it gets to the point of like serious abuse, child abuse cases. And it would, and then also, like, you know, you could have it being, it could be acute or it could be a chronic sort of thing where it could be happen in one instance or it could happen over a long period of time. If it happens in one instance, then it's not likely to be caught up in that sort of child abuse. But then also, it is just not very common. It's not very common at all. So that is why. But no, I think it's definitely incredibly sort of interesting, right? Because as I said, you could either be having sort of a single episode, sort of acute or chronic, you know, multiple episodes, and the sort of rate that it occurs, or the rate that this sort of happens to children younger than 16 years old, is about 0.002 to 0.0005% Yeah, percent. That's children.
Okay.
Yeah. Goodness under me. The age of 16. It's not common at all.
Yeah.
Or yeah. I mean, okay, so to make it slightly more understandable, 0.05 to 2 children for every 100,000 children.
Okay.
Under the age of 16. Right. Usually this happens when they're between 14 months to 2.7 years old, and that's usually when the caregiver is sort of diagnosed with this, which so again,
that's like max 700 cases in the UK. If everybody was children.
If everybody was children.
So like 30 cases, maybe 20 cases in the UK.
Yeah, not common at all. Yeah. And
if everyone was children.
And the thing is, what's interesting is that up top you brought up Gypsy Rose, who was, gosh, in her 20s, really, by the when it was sort of all found out.
Oh, shit, I didn't know she was that old.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she was, I'm pretty sure she was, I think she was about 21. Her age was lied about, so there were those issues there. But that is, I guess, that's an outlier, really, because if you look at the sort of data, it shows that, as I said, between 14 months and 2.7 years old is usually when the caregiver is sort of diagnosed. And that makes sense, if you think about it, because it's far easier to make a child look like a baby seem ill because they cannot talk. and you can feed them things, very and they will just take it.
And you're also much more monitored around that time as well.
Exactly. You're more likely to go to the doctors, and also it's just it's generally easier to make a baby ill because they're not very good at being alive.
Yeah.
They've not quite learned that
they're
skill.
They're quite dependent on you.
So, exactly. Yeah. They're entirely dependent on you.
Now, I know it's an interesting thing you said, like near the top of this episode, which I'm sure you may come on to, but I've been waiting for you to come on to it, and I want to pull it up. So you said in your definition of Munchausen syndrome, or in the definition you gave that I think was the one that was like in the 70s, that it's of mothers. Now, is this a thing? Like, you use the word mothers, and I thought that was really interesting. It might be a dated thing. But I just, I wonder what it was about.
I didn't even register that. So that was, that was the initial definition.
Yeah.
Obviously, that was in the 70s. Now, there is almost some precedent for that because it is like any caregiver can be the sort of the person that's done it, that does it. And that's really funny that you mentioned that because that's literally the next stat that I had on my page.
Hell yeah!
It's usually the mother of the child that sort of does this. So if we look at the sort of common characteristics of factitious disorder imposed on another, usually the sort of perpetrator is or the sort of the perpetrator or the person with the disorder is female, usually the victim's mother. They have a history of sort of childhood abuse or a history of Munchausen syndrome themselves, a personality disorder or a lack of support or disengagement from the other parent. They're often well educated, and this will come up later. It makes sense as to why they'd be often well educated. They rarely leave the bedside of the child or victim. I want to be clear, like we're talking about like a sort of abuse here. You know, the sort of the victim, and they can also have a close relationship with hospital staff because obviously they'll be there often. And if I found a paper that looked at data from 108 articles, which included 81 case reports, and again, this doesn't sound great in terms of data, but it's so uncommon that case studies are generally the most common thing, and then the sort of you have to have other studies that look at those case studies because I mean realistically you can't really study someone that has factitious disorder imposed on another after they've sort of been diagnosed necessarily because they were abusing a child and that has been sort of dealt with, right? So it's not
it's not going to carry on from that point.
Exactly. So it's not quite like having, say, bipolar disorder, where if you're diagnosed with bipolar disorder, we can look at the people that have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and just watch them for a bit and see what they do, you know? Because it's almost like, say you've got OCD, you take away, you sort of take away the sort of compulsions or, you know, the sort of tics or whatever.
Yeah.
You're not going to be studying the full thing, right?
Yeah.
So it's really hard to study this. So you've got to look at the sort of case studies sort of individually. Almost all of the perpetrators were female, 91% female, 1% female and male, and 7% unreported. So 1% female and male would be obviously
both.
And there could be a bias here in who they're doing this with, but then also again, bear in mind who's the primary caregiver usually?
Yeah, it could be a bias towards like most of the time the caregiver will be the mother.
So 23 cases, sorry, 23 cases of the ones that looked at, so 28% the perpetrator had a psychiatric diagnosis of factitious disorder imposed on self. In 28% of the cases the perpetrator had a psychiatric diagnosis. In 10% of those, it was factitious disorder imposed on self, depression in 9%, and personality disorders in 7%. And so that's not, obviously, not of the...
It's of the 28%.
That's of the total.
Oh.
Yeah. 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 Of the sort of total, not of the 28%, because you've got 10, 9, and 7, and then the rest are much less than that. But yeah, there's often personality sort of disorders involved in this, and that's why it's hard to really call this a disorder in and of itself, and why it was kind of described more as a syndrome, I guess, because a syndrome is sort of a collection of sort of symptoms or signs or whatever, and a disorder is slightly different from that. and this is, it's kind of similar to what we were talking about, sort of maladaptive daydreaming, if you recall, because since it's so, it's fairly common for a psychiatric diagnosis to, I mean, you know, 28%, one would assume that's, I'm fairly sure that's above the sort of, the mean for, you know, the average person.
Yeah.
Right.
I think the mean is about a third of people in their entire lifetime will
exactly
have something like that. Wow. Yeah.
So, you can see how, that may affect sort of like, the presentation of this. And it's difficult to say whether it would be necessarily a thing in itself or something that could be caused by other things, or it could obviously, of course, be both.
Mm.
So in more than a third, there was familial conflict or abuse. That was 36%. 17% had people, the sort of, the person with the disorder working in healthcare. And the most common type of, sort of falsification was induction, as in, You make them in. That's how you fake it. But in 15% of cases, there was more than one type of falsification. this is mad, though. The outcomes of this, of these ones that they looked at, 37% separation, 22% no follow-up, 14% imprisonment, 12% death of victim, and 10% treatment of perpetrator, and 4% continued living together. And the other 1%, I don't want to talk about, because it is incredibly, incredibly dark. But in more than 3/4 of cases, recurrence was present. So it would happen again, sort of thing. So this is from Munchausen Syndrome by Proxy, MSBP, a review regarding perpetrators of factitious disorder imposed on another, FDIA. That's from 2020. As you can see, it includes both factitious disorder,
imposed
another, yeah. And but yeah, exactly. So the diagnostic criteria for this is very short, very easy. I've just got, I think, four different points here. So A, psychological and physical signs and symptoms or induction, lesion or disease on an other are feigned in association with identified fraud. B, individual presents the other, the victim, as ill, impaired or injured. C, fraudulent behavior is evident even with the absence of obvious external rewards. And this is that's a very key part. Remember, we got to remember that it's not a disorder if we can look at someone and say, I understand why they are doing that.
Yeah.
You know, if you could be like, oh, I get why they're doing it, then, well, either you've got the disorder or it's not a disorder, right? And then D, individual's behavior is no longer well explained by a disorder such as delirium or other psychotic condition, right? So it wouldn't be a factitious disorder imposed on another if you were going through a period of psychosis,
yeah.
You know, for example. So this is why it's such a difficult one to talk about, because it's very difficult to wrap your head around, isn't it? Do you find?
More so than I was expecting.
Oh, right. I guess the part of it, why it's so difficult to wrap your head around, is because there's a massive gaping hole as to why. Like that's just, it's just such a non, like such an, it's not an understandable thing at all why somebody would do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think building any form of understanding, you have to just sort of focus on observing the phenomena, because mm-hmm. building any kind of understanding of it, well, the foundational layer is not there.
It's hard. It's hard to understand it. And I mean, it. I guess the way that we sort of set up our society, the way that we deal with people and their actions when they are harmful to others or erratic in some way and all of these things, we can label these behaviors as disordered. And so almost necessarily we label this behavior as disordered. But I think it's almost less understandable than something like, say, OCD or depression, all of these other things. You can almost get inside the head of someone and be like, oh, I guess I kind of get, I can understand all of this sort of thing, right? Mm. That makes almost logical sense. Like,
you
so
can
many
build
disorders,
an understanding of it. Yeah. You can build a framework to understand.
So many disorders, even in their irrationality,
yeah,
can appear in some senses logical.
Yeah.
Right? Like even sort of, DID, right? That makes sense as a response to trauma, right?
Yeah.
That your brain would be like, okay, cool, this real bad, so
I'm a
split up, bro. You deal with this, and the rest of us are gonna chill out back here.
Yeah.
You know, like that makes some sense, some logical sense. Dissociation, you know, like DPRD, right? That makes sense because you go through a traumatic experience, and your body's like, yo, I ain't in my body no more. What is going on? Like, it disconnects. It disconnects you from, like, the traumatic experience. Just abusing a child, like, in the first instance, is incredibly, like, I think incredibly difficult to wrap your head around, like, why you would want to do that. Yeah. But doing it in this very specific way that a obviously not very many people seem to do, but like at least some significant number of people do sort of consistently that in sort of almost predictable ways. I don't get it. Yeah. Like it doesn't seem to be out of a I want to harm this kid. You know what I mean? Because like you're taking them in for care. Like if you just want to harm a child, there are easier ways to do it.
But it's also not sense. Like I want the doctors to do a bunch of tests on my child to check they're okay, because you're inducing some of the bad symptoms.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's no way. Like so many things, there are ways of going, oh, I understand why, but this one is just so weird.
Yeah.
And your goal, if you care about this child, then your goal is for it to do well. But then you. And so that you could maybe form a framework as to like, I'm faking a bunch of illnesses so the doctors will test every single possible thing just in case it has the thing and they find something. But then if you're inducing those things, then that doesn't make sense. But and in which case you have to apply an understanding of like, okay, you don't love the thing, mm-hmm. but then you still care about it and you're taking it to doctors and stuff. And so you do love the thing, or don't you?
And I'm sure someone listening right now might be thinking, you're so right, dissonance is the perfect word for it, right? Someone listening right now might be thinking, well, maybe we just don't know what their motive is. Well, let me tell you this. There's also simulation, which can easily be confused for FDIA. And simulation, and I'll just read this as a quote. It's from a paper from 2017, Munchausen Syndrome and Munchausen Syndrome by Proxy, a narrative review. Fantastic paper, actually. It says, simulation is not considered a mental disorder. It is included in the DSM-5 and defined as intentional production of false or exaggerated physical or psychological symptoms motivated by external incentives in order to avoid mandatory military service, avoid work, obtain financial compensation, escape from criminal process, or obtain drugs. Simulation differs from factitious disorder in terms of motivation for production of symptoms. In simulation, the incentive is external, while factitious disorder lacks this incentive. There's no incentive. It doesn't make logical sense, and so we slap this label of disorder on it, which, like, you know, it makes sense in terms of how we as a society try to engage with and perceive the world. Like, if we don't understand something or if it's harmful and out of the ordinary, we slap the label disorder on it, which you know, we can talk about sort of the sort of good and bad of the label disorder, but it's kind of irrelevant to the point that's being sort of made here right now. It's just, this is baffling to me because it's just something that doesn't make any sense. And that is almost, the fact that it doesn't make sense is almost the reason for it being classified as some kind of disorder rather than just plain abuse.
Yeah.
You know? Like, there's almost not much to say here because it's just, what do you say?
Jamp and I were at the top of this. You sort of cautioned us away from this.
Mm-hmm.
Jamp and I sort of mentioned, maybe it's to be in the role of carer. Because like one of the theories about standard Munchausen's is like you want to be you want to be cared for. You want to be in the role of ill person because you like the experience of being cared for. Now that's not necessarily why people are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one hypothesis as to like what the motivation might be. And again, all of these things, big flag of hypothesis, big flag of like just us like spewing things around because there's no explanation and it's so frustrating and you want to try and understand it. Like you can understand the possibility of somebody wanting to be in a caring, nurturing role, wanting to infantilize their child forever so that they never have to not be in the role because that gives purpose. It gives you so much purpose to feel like you're needed. And maybe if your child is never going to grow up because they're so ill and that kind of thing might, obviously for many parents, that would be sad because you want your child to have as much possibility in life as possible. But it could be that you're addicted to being in the position of carer.
Mm-hmm.
And so you constantly try and recreate that position for yourself again.
Well, you're not far off of some hypotheses that we've got. So, I mean, I'll just skip to my sort of what causes this section. And, I mean, The reasons why it happens, fully understood. We don't really know. You're kind of hitting on something there. That when it comes to sort of factitious disorder imposed on self, you're right. Like, it could be because of the sort of wanting to be in that role of being cared for or being or whatever. But in this case, it could be that the sort of the carer or the parent just and this is from the NHS, I believe. They said that the parent or carer will have a need for their child to be treated as if they're ill or as being more unwell than they really are. Their behavior is intended to convince doctors that the child is ill. This may be because the parent or carer gains something such as attention, support, or closeness to the child, or maybe because they have anxiety or incorrect beliefs about their child's health and they need these beliefs to be confirmed and acted upon. But crucially, it says, and again, I'm quoting, the parent or carer is not always fully aware of the reasons for their own behavior. Right. And a lot of people, as we've seen, that with sort of FDIA, have personality disorders. And obviously, and this is coming from the NHS, they're characterized by emotional instability, impulsiveness, and disturbed thinking. So, like, this is... I think it's something that we're not going to be able to necessarily wrap our heads around. We're trying to apply our own logic to it, but even sometimes the people that are doing it are like, I don't know why I'm doing this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And there could be lots of different reasons. It's like an umbrella term for, like, some people might want attention, some people might want to be a carer, some people might be paranoid about their child's health, like, and all those would be labeled under the same thing.
Exactly. You've come to the almost exact problems with labeling any non-normative behavior as a disorder. And now, obviously, with this, it's harmful behavior to another, so that makes sense. But, like, we really test the limits when we just when we take non-normative behaviors and we slap a disorder label on them, because what that does is it groups them. Yeah. Right? So in some cases that's very useful, right, because there's consistency across them. But grouping this, when there could be so many different causes and reasons internally, it's difficult, right? It you could almost consider it to be limiting, because you're then looking for the cause of factitious disorders rather than looking for the causes for these people's behavior. It almost reminds me of, remember when we were talking about what was it called, Stockholm syndrome? Now, that's not really a thing, because I mean, for one thing, it was blown up by the media, and you know, the police that were involved in that situation were really not helping the hostages very much. And if we're being sort of rational people, we can understand why the people involved in that situation would have presented with Stockholm syndrome, you know. But by calling something Stockholm syndrome, by saying, you shouldn't like the people that have kept you hostage. And if you do like them, that's Stockholm syndrome. What you're doing is almost erasing the individual sort of, motivation for said sort of action or said presentation, right? Yeah. Like, you're not, like, you're necessarily sort of disregarding the fact that someone might have a valid reason, someone may have, like, an understandable reason.
They might have, like, if you take a bunch of people hostage in a bank, and then the media and, like, all the, like, the world wants to go, ooh, bad person, but then you find out the person taking them hostage has, like, $600,000 of debt to their cancer treatment, and their children are dying, and like this is what Breaking Bad was kind of about, wasn't it? It's like Breaking Bad is about we've got this idea of, like, someone who makes meth, right? And then and then giving a reason, it's like it creates this incredible cognitive dissonance where it's like, ooh, person doing thing I think bad, but also I like person. How do I make this make sense? I'll stretch it out over like 5 seasons.
And it strings you out until the end where you're like, I like person, but person really, really bad?
Yeah.
Do I still like person?
Ooh, we're going to think about this a lot and watch the ads.
Yeah, exactly. So, and what I'm saying here is not that this should not be classified as a disorder, but what I'm pointing out is that there is perhaps the chance that we are limiting our understanding of these cases by trying to understand them in the context of the disorder as a whole, right? Does that make sense? Because any answer that you come up with in each individual case must then necessarily gel with or corroborate the disorder as a whole.
Yeah.
Right? And that could potentially be limiting if that behavior can be explained in some sense outside of the disorder, which is why, obviously, we have so many caveats when it comes to disorders. For example, we have the caveat of, if you've got an understandable reason, It ain't factitious disorder.
And if you've got another thing, it ain't that either.
Yeah, if you've got, well, if you've got not necessarily just another thing.
Like psychosis.
Psychosis. Well, if you've got another reason, or if you've got a thing that makes you think you've got a reason,
yeah,
then, yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so what you're saying is Munchausen's by proxy is like diarrhea.
Oh my God, stop.
Not everything is
diarrhea. Not everything is diarrhea.
It is, it's a symptom.
It's not... like gay people.
Much more apt. I like that.
Explain, no, explain. It's so, a reference to previous episodes. Corey
has, an incredible quote that's like, being gay is not the symptom, it's not the disease, it's the symptom.
Yeah, being gay isn't a disease, being gay is a symptom. Now, what I mean
just
by
like
that...
Just like diarrhea is not a disease, it's a symptom that can be caused by lots of things. And being gay could be caused by some genes, it could be caused by some nurturing. And just like diarrhea, it has multiple causes and is a presenting symptom as opposed to the cause. Yeah.
Yeah, and a key point there is that if you've got 10 people with diarrhea, you could have 10 different reasons that someone has diarrhea.
Yeah.
You know, so in the same sense that if you look at 10 gay people, we don't know what makes people gay, but there could be 10 different sort of pathways to that person being gay. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm really pointing out here. Let's just quickly run through the symptoms, or the signs rather, of FDIA. Goodness me. Factitious disorder imposed on another. So here is what the sort of people will look out for, right? Here are some of the warning signs, and I'll just rapid fire through these from the NHS. Symptoms only appear when the parent or carer is present. The only person claiming to notice symptoms is the parent or carer. The parent or carer doesn't let healthcare professionals see the child on their own. The parent or carer talks for the child, or the child refers to the parent or carer rather than speaking for themselves. I'm sorry, I'm just getting flashbacks to watching that Gypsy Rose sort of TV show.
I never watched it.
It was very good. Yeah, it was very good, but like all of these things were present in, at least in this fictionalized version of this case.
Can I quickly ask a question?
Yeah, go for it.
It seems to be implied... potentially implied, at least, that the child because they want to be there with the child when the carer is there, that the child sort of learns to pretend to have the symptoms, or learns to answer that they do have the symptoms.
I don't think it's necessarily the child learns to pretend. It's, I think, look at it this way: if you're a child, and you know the person that when you're growing up, your only way to interact with sort of the greater world is via your parent.
Yeah.
As a child, you know, sort of relatively, you know nothing, and your parent, relative to you, knows everything in the world.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You.
I remember that. Nice.
Right.
Yeah.
So you can learn essentially everything. You learn everything primarily via your parents. And so if your parent tells you you are sick, you can't then say, no, I'm not, because your understanding of what sick is comes from the person who's telling you that you're sick.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I think that's kind of where it is. And if you go to the doctors, and you're often going to the doctors, and you could tell the child, for example, no, you can't answer this because you're not able to answer it properly. I know. Right? And they'll look to you to answer it for them.
Man, that's so
all of these different things, right? And what I'm pointing out here is that it's not necessarily that the child learns to lie. But even especially when the child is like, you know, when the symptoms are being induced, the child doesn't necessarily need to lie. But like that in the cases where it's not being induced, that's why they would speak over the child, or they sort of train the child to refer to them, all these sorts of things. Right. I guess the point is that it's not about making the child also pretend, because you're the kid's world.
Yeah.
You know? You can manipulate them into sort of doing or saying whatever, really. So some other warning signs is that the child has inexplicably poor response to medicine. Basically, medicines don't work in the way that they should. Like, really, really, they work poorly. If one health problem is resolved, then a new set of symptoms might suddenly appear.
Ooh, Hydra.
Or the symptoms don't seem plausible, or, you know, like, oh, for example, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, he's been bleeding, this is for the NHS, he's been bleeding profusely, but the kid seems fine. And you're like, well, if he'd lost that much blood, he would be quite ill. Or, like, no, he hit his head very, very, oh, he hit it so hard, and look, and you look at the head, there's no lump, and there's no concussion, you're like, he hit his head.
I don't think he's fine.
Hit his head. Or, you know, or the parent or carer, and this is, I just want to go through these, because they're very interesting, and it makes sense to sort of know how these sort of present. Constantly sort of changing doctors, or going to different care facilities is another one, or daily activities for the child, the victim, being limited far more than you'd expect for someone with that condition. So, for example, let's say, you know, you tell a child, oh no, you can't go out, you can't go and play outside because you'll simply perish.
Yeah.
And you know, they've got like something, they've got something that wouldn't prevent a, yeah, they wouldn't prevent a child from going outside, sort of thing. Incredibly hyperbolic there, sure. But you get the
or like a low immune system or
exactly
like
yeah poor immune system, you can't go outside, you can't all
see other stuff, people ever,
exactly,
anyone tries to talk to you,
exactly
them,
exactly
them.
Yeah,
cover your mouth.
You've also got recommended treatments and reassurance not being accepted by the perpetrator or the parent or carer, and they insist on new treatments or looking into it further, or the parent or carer, and this one is pretty grim. The parent or carer encourages medical staff to perform often painful tests and procedures on the child, a test that most parents would only agree to if they were persuaded that it was absolutely necessary. And here, I'll just run through the types of abuse that are present in these. So, like, usually these are sort of found out sort of upon sort of diagnosis of the sort of perpetrator, the parent or the carer. Exaggerating, distorting, or lying about the child's symptoms or medical history or tests or diagnoses. And bear in mind, all of these are cases, all of these are abuse. These are all abuse, and that's why I'm going through them, just so we know, because people have this really crappy view of abuse where they're like, if you weren't hit, then it's not abuse. You know what I mean? Like, it's if it wasn't physical, then it's not abuse. And it's just like, that is, it's not how it works, right? You can abuse a child without laying a finger on them, and people need to understand that. So, exaggerating, distorting, or lying about the kid's symptoms, medical history, or tests, or diagnoses, falsifying documents, deliberately contaminating or manipulating clinical tests to fake evidence of illness, like, you know, messing with blood and urine samples and whatnot, poisoning their child with sort of unsuitable or non-prescribed medicine, and that's not just so, like, you could obviously say that they're poisoning their child with medicine that they know doesn't work, won't work because they're not ill, but also poisoning their child for like with just other medicine to make them appear ill, right? So both of those things. Infecting their child's wounds or injecting the child with dirt or feces. Inducing unconsciousness by suffocating their child, not treating or mistreating genuine conditions so that they get worse, or withholding food, resulting in, like, you know, when the child is young, because bear in mind,
this frail is... frail look.
Yeah, remember, yeah. No, but bear in mind, this often is diagnosed when children are under a year old,
yeah.
Or sorry, 14 months old, so just over a year old to just under 3 years old.
Yeah.
Withholding food to stunt their physical and mental development.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it's just not nice at all to think about. Like, I mean, if you look at the case of Gypsy Rose, for example, right? Like, it was you can't have sugar, or you need to be in this wheelchair, sort of thing. All of these different things that you just sort of lie to the kid about. But let's just quickly go over how you would sort of deal with this. So. Obviously, this is a case of child abuse. The NHS in the UK doesn't manage it alone. You get the police or social services involved. And usually, the first priority, obviously, the top priority here is the child,
yeah.
Right? Is the victim. So you protect the child, you figure out how they are, and you get them healthy again. So you've got a plan of rehabilitation for the kid. And then you get a social care team involved as well. You try and get them back to a normal lifestyle. You've got to give them sort of ongoing help, give them a realistic understanding of how their health is and all of that sort of stuff. And this is something that it points out here, the NHS website points out. It's common for older children to feel loyal to their parent or carer and a sense of guilt if the person is removed from the family, which makes sense because, like, this is what's really difficult, I think, for a lot of people. That quite a few people have said this to me, that, like, you know, your parent can be the worst, right? But you still have so many people saying, well, they're still, you've probably heard someone say this, right?
They're still your mom.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you almost cannot vent about, you know, a parent without someone being like, oh, well, it's still your dad. Well, it's still your mom.
Yeah.
Like, right. But maybe we should move our society away from that sort of thing, because it doesn't matter what your familial relationship is with someone. If they're abusive, and that's bad, right?
Yeah.
training kids to feel loyal to abusive parents just leads to more kids being abused for longer. So there's that problem as well that you've got to deal with. But once the kid is safe, you can then try and treat the parents, sort of, or the carers' underlying issues. So intensive psychotherapy, family therapy, sort of basically trying to figure out what is causing this disorder and just dealing with it, essentially. So if it's family therapy, that's to deal with sort of issues within the family that might be causing them to do this sort of thing. The really intensive psychotherapy is sort of going into childhood issues to see where, if there's anything coming from there. You could be detained in a psychiatric ward under the Mental Health Act if it's real bad, so that, you know, you could basically closely monitor them. And it says on the NHS website that the best results are achieved in cases where the parent or carer understands and acknowledges the harm that they've caused, is able to communicate the underlying motivations and needs that led them to fabricate or cause the illness, or is able to work together with the healthcare and other professionals. So that is factitious disorder imposed on another, or Munchausen's by proxy syndrome. I mean, it is, in a lot of, it's horrific when you really dig into it, you know. Yeah. Like, we've been light throughout this episode, but I want anyone listening to know that we're not making light of sort of the actual situations that are affecting actual people here. Mm-hmm. You know, it is truly horrific, and honestly, I guess getting this out to more people, understanding this to a greater degree, can only help, right? You know, you've seen the signs to watch out for. You know, you can find them on the NHS website. You can find them sort of in many places. And yeah, it's just something that is spoken about almost in this sort of fantastical way, where it's like, oh my god, this crazy, insane thing. But the reality of it is that it's child abuse. You know,
it's just horrible.
Exactly. And like, we've got cases like Gypsy Rose, which are, I guess, honestly, like, not non-normative. Like, that went on for a long time.
Yeah.
And resulted in a murder. You know, it's a true crime story, if anything. And that's why people latch onto that one. And that results in a sort of misunderstanding, I think, of how this works, because necessarily the parent is painted as a villain. You know, and I'm not saying that they don't do horrific, disgusting, awful things, but that, I don't think the viewpoint of seeing people as irredeemable
villains
is useful in helping people, like, ultimately, right? Like, you know, I don't think saying, this parent is evil and bad is a necessary part of removing the child from the parent and treating the parent for their condition and treating the child for their trauma. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessary to say this person is evil. Like, we don't understand why they're doing it. Like, there could be underlying mental health issues. And
well, they don't understand why they're doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, I'm not saying have sympathy for child abusers, but what I'm saying is that, like, painting anyone as a villain when it comes to mental health issues of mental health is, I think, unhelpful. It's not conducive to solving the problem. I think understanding the behavior and dealing with it, like, you know, I'm not saying, oh, let's go easy and let's let them deal with the behavior. Absolutely deal with the behavior. But painting the person as a villain is an extra step that I think hinders any actual progress. Because instead of seeing this as something that we need to understand or figure out or deal with in some way, it's just, look at these evil people and the evil things that they do. Right? You don't put evil people in therapy to make them less evil. You chuck them in jail to make them, you know, to make them pay. And that's not necessarily going to be the best. That's not necessarily going to be the best thing for the family or for any of the individuals involved. So, you know, just whatever. I don't know how to end this. You guys got anything you want to say?
No.
There's nothing to add.
No, that was horrible.
It's just horrible.
It's horrible, isn't it? Yeah. Well,
thanks, Corey.
Maybe we'll
thank the patrons for this one.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, patrons. Yeah,
thanks, patrons, for this trauma.
I don't like doing dark stuff. Dark stuff is the patrons' fault. Blame them. Let's just cheer it up a little bit. Let's just bring it up to the end with a quick fire quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. FDIA edition.
Well, the rules for the quickfire quiz are the same as always. I'll ask one question. That's one question between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after finished asking the question wins. What do they win, Jem?
Nothing.
You gosh darn right. Luke, what is your buzzer?
Okay, I'm going to go with a normal one this week because it's too horrible.
Good. Jem?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
That's how I feel.
My question for you is, What is another name for Munchausen by proxy syndrome? Jamp, I think you came in with the side first.
FDIA, which stands for... I've forgotten the F. Something dis... No,
Jamp answer.
Oh my God, how have I forgotten the F? How have I forgotten the F?
F's in the chat.
I've actually forgotten the F. That's horrible.
Okay, Luke, you're coming in for a chance to steal.
Fictitious disorder inflicted on another.
No. Incorrect, Jamp. Another steal.
Factitious disorder.
Ding, ding, ding. That is correct. It is factitious. F-A-C-T-I-T-I-O-U-S. Disorder imposed on another. That is it for us now. Well done, Jamp, for winning the quick fire quiz. Let's move on to thanking our patrons.
Yeah, and thanks, patrons.
Realistically though, the patrons that we're thanking right now,
it's a horrible experience.
No, the patrons that we're about to thank right now, the new patrons, are probably not responsible for this.
Thanks, patrons.
So let's actually genuinely thank them.
The only patrons we like
currently.
No, I'm sorry.
We like them all, but this is a horrible
We love
experience.
Your suggestions.
Yeah, this was not a fun usually. This was not a fun one to do.
Especially for you. You had to do it twice. You had to research it, then say it.
Yeah. Ooh, it's hard to make a light podcast about something that dark, isn't it?
Yeah.
So let's first go through and thank all of our new patrons. I'm going to thank Sarah Jones.
Thank you, Ruth Murdoch.
Thank you, Jaden Davey.
Thank you, Rosa.
Thank you, Desiree Dahl.
Thank you.
Sorry. I'm so sorry.
We'll say it together. Thank you, Miley Essex.
Thank you, Alexander Finn.
Thank you, Thank you. Apophis the Rhino.
Wow, you got like one and a half thanks there, Apophis the Rhino.
Thank you, Apophis the Rhino. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Two and a half. Amazing.
Thank you, Apophis the Rhino.
Thank you.
Well, that is it for us this week. We hope you had, a good time. We hope that the episode is over for you now.
We had a horrible time.
Before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producers Rosa Rodriguez and Danito. And thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday. And why not leave us a nice wee review? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys. Or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, here on YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCorey everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.